Joe, how are you doing?
I'm just doing terrific, Tim. How are you?
Very good. Well, you said last week you wanted to talk about Elvis Presley.
Elvis the pelvis.
Elvis the pelvis, yes.
Now, as he was known.
He was quite a phenomenon in his own time. Probably the first rock idol, right? First rock idol.
Yeah.
You sent me that article by Miles Mathis regarding Elvis as an intelligence operation. That was rather provocative, but given the history of things, it's not shocking. It's it was a time I would have laughed at that article, but now that I'm older and wiser and much more jaded and more paranoid, justifiably so, I can't disregard what Mr. Mathis had to say in the article. So, your take on Elvis the Pelvis Presley, was it an intel operation?
Yeah, I think it's almost certain that he was. In fact, I hadn't read Miles Mathis' excellent article, which I think everyone should take a peek at. And I'll, as we go through the discussion tonight, I'll refer to some aspects of it, and then I'll also talk about some original thoughts I've had on Elvis. But Miles points out that, Presley has just an unusual amount of connections into what seem to be intelligence-based individuals. And he also has an extraordinary connection into the Jewish community. One thing that absolutely shocked me about the article is that in the original Memphis Mafia, you have the individuals George Klein, Marty Lacker, and Larry Geller. I knew about those individuals and their Jewish background. But Alan Fortas, that just floored me. Alan Fortas was basically the nephew of Abe Fortas, who was a very controversial U.S. Supreme Court justice and someone that I think was almost certainly involved in basically the secret society MK Ultra activities. So
wasn't he forced to resign from the Supreme Court from corruption?
Yeah, that's right. Hard to imagine.
I know. It's like
how could that ever occur? But
it was bad.
Yeah, it was so bad that they actually had to force him out. But yeah. I mean, so this is not a really normal or healthy background, for someone who's going to be a cultural icon to come out of. And don't want to be a scratchy record, but if you look at the MKUltra predecessor, the Macy Conference, and then before that, the Authoritarian Personality by the American Jewish Committee, which is online and people should check out. You have this odd connection of psychologists and intelligence individuals and this large component of Jewish individuals, very unusual fraction of the whole observable secret society phenomena. And so, it raises the question as to what is the participation here, because the reason I bring this up, Tim, not to enrage our Jewish listeners or to bring the dreaded anti-Semitism curse upon me, but it's just because of the conclusion of the Authoritarian Personality, which if people, question my veracity, just go online. It's available. go to chapter 23, the conclusion, and read the last three paragraphs, and you'll see that this organization talks about using eros to control the masses, right? They say we're perfectly justified in doing this. In fact, we're going to do it. And then this group then, you know, is then becomes part of what is MK Ultra and Stanford Research Institute and all of these different trajectories that lead to this bad project that damaged our culture. Can you know, in a large fraction of it be traced right to here? And so when you look at the timing of that and then look at Elvis Presley, you can see that the kind of links up pretty well, that if they made this decision, you know, in the 40s, that they were going to go forward with this. And then you look at when Presley is basically starting to be groomed to become an icon, it, you know, if you just ask yourself the question, was Elvis Presley one of the mass control of society, sex, drugs, and rock and roll that the authoritarian personality says they're going to be using, in other words, eros, to control population, then it just makes perfect sense. And so then when I read Miles's article and he lists all of this, these Jewish background of Elvis, it raises the question. And the other thing that I was sort of intrigued that Miles Mathis pointed out is that Presley was Jewish, that his mother was a known Jewish individual. So the maternal lineage, I guess, was established, and that on her gravestone, they actually had the Star of David. And then when the grave was moved to Graceland, it was taken off as though they were trying to hide something. Presley himself always wore the chai pendant, which is the Hebrew phrase basically meaning life. And it's actually aspect of the Jewish religion. And so this all fits together pretty well into a straightforward reading of the conclusion of the authoritarian personality, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it seems to be consistent with that agenda, the degradation, the sexualization of culture, the whole idea of infusing society with eros. This was seemed to be the agenda of the cultural Marxists. Obviously, you had Eros and Civilization, right? The book by what's his name?
Herbert Marcuse.
Herbert Marcuse, who went out to Hollywood. Interesting enough.
Yeah.
But Theodore Adorno, too, played a big part in this. And also this, the whole idea of weaponized music, because you have Schoenberg and 12-step atonal music and these things, using music as a way to, I guess, excite the passions or upset society. So this isn't anything new. I think Plato wrote about that. Any significant change in society's music will result in political change. And we definitely saw that in the 60s, in the 50s and 60s, that's for sure. Elvis's performance seems rather benign compared to today. He's not Miley Cyrus, nor is he Marilyn Manson, but to get there, you'd have to introduce Elvis Presley at first to introduce these things gradually. Otherwise, you get a immediate adverse reaction, and this way they slowly introduce people to these things. The hips, shaking his hips and these things, slowly sexualizing society. I think in the article, Miles Mathis points out that this is the way the oligarchs control the middle class through entertainment, and I think he puts it this entertainment itself, it isn't a bad thing in a mild form, but we get an overdoses of it now, where we never have a moment to think or reflect because we're constantly entertained. If we're not being traumatized, we're being entertained. So that's what's happened. That's how it's been weaponized. If I could find the quote in the article, here. But, you know, like, over, it's all overkill, whether it's sports, entertainment, celebrity culture. It's, you know, just used to be these things were on the periphery, something you did, you know, during your leisure time. Now it dominates the news almost, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so we have an artificial matrix that we slip into.
Here's the quote. I'm sorry. Yeah, give me this. Do him justice here. Elvis was another cog in a long program, another ring in the circus. Like sport, sex, and music were diversions from more important matters, and Elvis joined the last two in a brilliant manner. He appealed to both men and women, diverting the eyes and ears of both. In small doses, such diversions are harmless and may even be salutary. We are told that Elvis helped loosen some hips in the 1950s, and maybe he did. The sexual revolution hasn't been all bad, and I'm not here to put all us back in our pens. Just the opposite. Remember, I paint nudes for a living. Okay, that's what he... but he goes, however, modern diversions are not delivered in small, homeless doses. They are now delivered 24-7 in huge, big gulp doses, our throats being massaged constantly to allow higher levels of ingestion. And the acceleration in our current mess was started after World War II. Of course, that coincides with authoritarian personality. It wasn't an accident. It was planned. It was heavily funded. And from the point of view of the governors, it has been a smashing success. So,
absolutely. And so you have to place Presley and his success in the media not as something that was history unfolding, but rather something that was brought about. The best place for people just to begin to see the absolute control of the media and its impact is right at the start of the youth culture, right at the start of the psychedelic revolution, with Gordon Wasson's story that appeared in the cover of Life magazine in May 1957. And the story is basically total fiction. It's a propaganda piece. It's very easy to demonstrate this. And then on the cover of the magazine, you can actually see that the government is attempting to twiddle with your mind, because they're using obvious neuro-linguistic programming. They have the description of the trip that Gordon Wasson takes as, you know, seeing magical visions in the Mexican desert, but it's in a reset black box on the cover, and above it you have supposedly another article which is called Great Adventures, and then underneath that expression about the magic mushrooms, you have the words teenage allowances. And, you know, I've shown this to people who are familiar with neurolinguistic programming, and they all agree it's just as obvious as can be that this is an attempt, you know, to get at the subconscious. So, you know, you were dealing with a very sophisticated and very large-scale, well-funded project that already controlled the media, 1957. So when you see Elvis coming, you know, basically before this, with a very sexualized and an incrementally advanced sexuality, right? I mean, you look at like Pat Boone. I remember Eldridge Cleaver talked about this. He said, you know, you had Pat Boone. You know, he'd come out and he would just have his, you know, little blue suede shoes on and a seersucker suit. And then Presley comes on, he says, don't step on my blue suede shoes. You know, says you had this whole ratcheting up of aggression and sexuality with Elvis that was completely distinct from all of the music culture that came before. So I would suggest that his stage persona and his music had been basically carefully crafted in the same way that the Beatles would be. And that one of the things was not just to basically release sexuality. And, you know, people wonder if I'm opposed to sex. I mean, what they're trying to do is to lead us into the pornographic culture, atomize us, you know, to separate us from family and from ethnic community so that we're just simply individuals.
Well, because sex in its full meaning is both unitive and procreative. They're the ones that cheapen it and turn it into a, you know, this, you know, a recreational activity. But that always results in a reduction of human beings, because this is how life is generated. Of course, it generates life, and you know, if you're open to that, if you're appreciative of that reality of sex, you're gonna be more responsible with your behavior, and you're gonna be around to take care of the children you create, and you can have families and these things. Obviously, if you sex is very easily weaponized, one thing Elvis did was also popularize black music and sexual. There was always high
Elvis
sexuality.
The integrator, yeah.
Yeah, and this was a way to promote sexual responsibility by promoting the blues. It mainstreamed this, and this was I think a rather obvious cultural agenda. By promoting that, I mean that's. I mean, we all hear about this, and this goes back to jazz music in the '20s. You know.
Yeah. They thought that the African American community had a basically a different cultural sexuality.
Yes.
And so they wanted to integrate that into the middle class, because in the middle class, sexuality at this time was strictly contained in within marriage, or at least it was how the culture was designed. I mean, if you were a woman who had a child out of wedlock, there was shame.
Yes, there was stigma. Right? There's actually stigma to it. Yeah.
So there was a completely different culture, different perspective, and to change that to where you have single moms, pornographic males, atomized society, and basically a slave system,
mm-hmm.
Because people can't protect themselves in a union. In a family and an ethnic community, I mean, they don't have this capacity anymore. So, you know, it goes along incrementally. You know, when you come to the Rolling Stones, you can basically see them overtly promoting black, you know, rock and roll acts, Muddy Waters,
mm-hmm.
Chuck Berry, right? So they're, in fact, they actually are saying that that's what our role is. That's what we want to do, is we want to bring black music to the middle class. Now, why they would decide that this was something that was going to be beneficial, you know, they're never asked about that. But they definitely had that as an agenda. But they had already had a 10-year run of rhythm and blues music being popularized by Elvis Presley. So there was others besides Elvis, but Elvis was certainly the best known. And so, you know, if you just look at it as a project, right, just say, just as a point of consensus, just okay, I accept for that purpose that it was a project. Elvis really makes sense when you fit him into that context, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. And especially given your research, your and Jan Irvin's research regarding the Grateful Dead, and also the Beatles,
yeah.
Rolling Stones, and these things. The Laurel Canyon scene. This was a way of introducing.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense, you know.
Yeah. One thing that's interesting is one thing is.
And going back.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Hello.
No. Go ahead. I didn't interrupt. I'm sorry.
Okay. One thing is.
I'm right here.
Is in the article he points out. Well, one thing is this character, Colonel Tom Parker. And his strange background, and also Elvis's meteoric rise, which is really inexplicable outside it being a project, because at the time we're talking inside a year, he just shoots to superstardom, right? I mean, and so he's being promoted on television. He's getting movie contracts after a year, within a year of his first record, which is strange, you know. They made a star out of him because he says in the article, they can create the hit singles because they're the ones that determine what the hit singles are, you know, through the charts, manipulating the charts and the playtime on the radio. Yeah. You know, so they're in a position to manipulate the culture to create the icon, you know, so.
Exactly. And that's something we have to, as a culture, we have to stop letting them do to us. They create these idols, right? The idols are projects, and we should expose this. Elvis was if you look at his meteoric rise, totally artificial. Same thing about the Beatles, right? Gloria Steinem, we've talked about her. I mean, mm-hmm. She's another one, just comes out of nowhere, just suddenly a pre-existing woman's movement that was focused on economic issues is just overwhelmed by the publicity this one individual is getting, and she's wanting to rip apart the family. Right. This meteoric rise to fame is typically a symptom, in my opinion, of someone who's basically part of the project. And that's the way to understand them. And I'll give you like an interesting little tidbit, can I, about Elvis?
Sure.
A little piece of my original sort of background on him. Miles didn't mention this, but I think it's fascinating, is that Elvis on stage, the EMI logo, which was, you know, the dog and the phonograph, and underneath it you had the words, "My master's voice."
Is that EMI or RCA?
Well, it's just, that's the same thing, actually.
It's the same thing? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, RCA was a, that was spun off from EMI, okay. Which actually was, I mean, there's a process of distinct ownership of the different companies. I think the first one was Victor.
Yeah, but RCA Victor,
Yeah, and, but RCA spins off, and then EMI spins off. So at different times, different company had the logo, but I think in every instance, the companies were, in fact, related to military intelligence. And EMI, of course, then is the group that brings out the Beatles.
Yes.
Right? And Joseph Lockwood, a bizarre Jewish individual with backgrounds into military intelligence, then hires Brian Epstein, equally bizarre Jewish individual, to bring the Beatles to the world. But they could become popular with this kind of music because in front of them had been Elvis Presley.
Yes.
So yeah. It all suddenly seems pretty much planned, doesn't it?
Yeah, and they themselves, Beatles, start by covering a lot of the same songs, artists that Elvis Presley would do.
Yeah.
Twist and Shout, you know, Long Tall Sally, you know, and then they start doing their own material. It seems like to unleash, and again, this music, the blues, jazz, the stuff, if it's sequestered in its own area, the lifestyles of some of these artists can be interesting to say the least, but once it gets it starts to pollute mm-hmm. the general public, it becomes destructive. Because if you look at the life of Louis Armstrong, yep. or any of these artists, or Chuck Berry, you know, or Little Richard, you don't want people to emulate their lifestyle.
No, I mean, basically,
it fails the categorical imperative. Let's just say that.
Yeah, I would agree. You can just go by them point by point, and you can, as you say, they're interesting, they're talented, but in general, their culture, they absolutely cannot be. You cannot have a culture with this group as role models.
No, they need to be
Elvis Presley.
Yeah, this type of art, this type of artist needs to be kept in his ghetto, more or less. Otherwise, it's dangerous.
Well, exactly. I mean, you cannot. You see, this is the absolutely transparent point. Is if these individuals become role models, you will basically have a shattered culture. You literally, it's like losing a nuclear war.
Yeah.
I mean, this is how devastating this is going to be. And so when you look. Then go forward and you see, you know, the Grateful Dead or Jim Morrison, right? And the kind of lifestyles that they promote, drug use, sexual promiscuity. As you said, and it just, I think it's really well stated, Tim, is that, you know, they're interesting and you can basically write about them as a phenomena, but you must never make them role models, ever. They have to be sequestered. And the group that brings this to our attention, that brings into our culture, knows it. They are perfectly aware of what the effect will be. And you see, this is just it condemns and convicts the secret society as having deliberate cultural debasement. Mm-hmm. And this goes all the way back to at the beginning of the 20th century with Edward Bernays, Sigmund Freud's nephew. And not just a nephew, but a double nephew. So you have basically, you know, an incestual family relationship with Freud that produces Edward Bernays. And if you compare Bernays with Presley, it's very interesting because Bernays brought out Caruso, who was seen as too sexual, basically, for modern tastes, but he was able to get him, you know, into cultural life. He also brought out Nijinsky, who was the ballet individual who would mime masturbation on stage, right, in certain of the performances. And then Bernays brought out a play called Damaged Goods, which was the first really overtly sexual play that had ever made it to Broadway. And the New York Times, the tainted criminal organization, then made the statement that this is 6 o'clock in America, you know, very prescient, right? So Bernays then seeds the ground, right? You have this incrementalism where you have Caruso, Nijinsky, you have Damaged Goods, and Bernays also develops the NAACP. So you have integration, right? So this is the other thing, which is then going to be part of the rock and roll phenomena that'll be, you know, occurring later on in the 50s. And now it is fascinating to then see that Bernays worked for 10 years with Gordon Wasson, who then becomes not only the chairman of foreign relations, but the individual who then goes on to start the psychedelic revolution. He's the one who then had the BS story, which on the cover of Life magazine, about how wonderful it is to take these psychedelic drugs. And so now, you know, this is all in the 50s, and you've got Presley, you know, basically, you know, seeding the ground that's going to be the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and then into Woodstock, Altamont, drug taking, the whole counterculture, and the shattering of the ethnic communities that would have been able to resist slavery, right? So it's what we're looking at when you see Presley is just a very important cog, as Miles pointed out, in this process, which, as you pointed out, is made up of individuals that should have been sequestered culturally, but because they could damage culture, and because I think they've been designed to damage culture, their personas were created, they were able to have this terrible effect on us.
Yeah. And of course, during that period, critical period, the post-war period, right after, you know, World War II, you have Alfred Kinsey and his book on female and male sexuality, his books on female and male sexuality, and his dubious and criminal methodology. Nevertheless, is being promoted not only by the university system, but also by the foundations, by the Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, Time Life, being put on the cover of Time Magazine. Again, all this is being, you know, again, being promoted for a reason. Oh, and I think Playboy comes out in 1954, 55.
Yep.
Where Hugh Hefner serendipitously acquires the nude photographs of Marilyn Monroe before she's a star. Then she becomes.
How did that happen?
Yeah. So all of a sudden, the magazine flies off the racks. Someone should do an investigation of Playboy magazine. I suspect it probably had something to do with the CIA's, you know, Mockingbird or Congress for Culture Freedom Project applied domestically, because they funded, you know, thousands of magazines, journals, and political
journals. Absolutely. We'll do a show on that. Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah, we need to do that.
So none of this is just, you also have coordination with the legal system, because you have the Roth decision, which destroys the ability, it declares obscenity free speech, and that destroys the ability of local communities to maintain any moral standards in the name of, you know, free speech. Bergman v. Parker, which is allows for urban renewal, which is pretty much allows for the oligarchs to steal the property, you know, that they covet by declaring it blighted. And this allows for, you know, generations later for eventual gentrification and things like that. The destruction of that's all also part of the destruction of the ethnic neighborhoods, particularly the ethnic Catholic neighborhoods. This also was a stumbling block to this agenda, because obviously if these groups maintain their ethnic religious identity, they're not going to be as vulnerable to the blandishments and seductions of Hollywood, of these record companies, Madison Avenue, which by all appearances seem to be all acting in coordination. So call me a conspiracy theorist, that's fine.
Yeah. But I mean,
yeah, go ahead. You there? So you're breaking up, that's why. Joe, you're breaking
up. Can you hear me?
Let me give you a call back.
Am I breaking up still?
Yeah, let me see if I can get a better connection. I'll give you a call back.
All right, we'll do.
Okay.
All right, I'll just...
Yeah.
Okay, we're back. We're back. Sorry about that. Bad connection. Sound good now. So where were we? You're talking about this idea of all this stuff being coordinated. You're about to say something?
Right. And, basically, I was just going to point out that it clearly was all coordinated. You can basically demonstrate this just from the facts that have been proven. I mean, particularly relating to MKUltra, relating to, the Gordon Wasson campaign. And so you know that the project is in motion. You can pretty easily put the individuals into the places that, all of this stuff is taking place. But the thought I was going to make about ethnic communities was an actual example of a friend of mine who had grown up in an Irish community near Lake Erie, and he had an experience where, as a young boy, someone came into town and was trying to sell dirty pictures, and I guess had been successful to some extent. And the fathers found out and just beat him up, right? Okay, so that couldn't happen in an atomized, deracinated, kind of the middle class, so-called, right?
Yeah, because you knock on your neighbor's door, hey, there's a guy selling dirty pictures, let's go get him. And you're like, leave me alone.
Yeah.
I don't know you from Adam. Who are you?
Yeah. And so you can see the difference. I mean, that example really illustrates for people the difference between the exact power that these ethnic communities had that had to be shattered. You can see why they needed to do this, right? And you can really then see, if you look at the individuals today who live in the deracinated, I don't even know what you want to call it, suburbia, but it expands from the inner city all the way out. I guess pornographic culture would be a way to describe it, mm-hmm. where the moms are singles and the men, watch pornography. You don't have the kind of family structures, obviously, because there aren't families. You don't have the kind of ethnic community that could be something that should be something would help defend a person against this kind of intrusion into their life by, the government. And so you're just a sitting duck, you're just a sitting duck. And this is why we've got to change this. We have to, promote the strength and virtue that lay at the base of the ethnic communities, right? They had strength, moral character, and virtue, right? These were, elements of personality that were promoted in the context of the ethnic community. And so we today have to try to recreate that, and it's going to be difficult because we're swimming upstream, because we're inside a not just a pornographic media, but a media that has expanded into our lives a dozenfold, right? I mean, you have the internet in front of you from the second you get up in the morning with your iPhone till the last pornography clip as you go to bed at night.
Yeah. And when you're subjected to all this information and sensory stimuli, you never have a moment to reflect or think. That's what the news does to us. The constant news, there's no analysis, there's no follow. It's just constant one bad story after another, one scandal after another, one outrage after another. You become desensitized to it. Each event, there's no context, there's no theme, there's no pattern. And as a result, you live from day to day and you don't think, you feel, you emote. And that's the problem with today's media. It's designed to overwhelm you. It's
That's brilliantly said. Yeah. Couldn't agree more. I mean, so basically what we're dealing with is fake news, which is to say propaganda, a particular kind of propaganda. When you look at the alternative media, which, of course, the expression fake news was designed to hobble, you really see that, in fact, the name is completely misapplied because they don't do news. I mean, what we do in a show like this is analysis, right? We really try to bring up facts and put them into a context from which people can think, or we try to think, to try to draw inferences, you know, try to make logical progression, approach conclusions through an analysis, right? And we show the connections of these things, analytic connections. Man, the news doesn't do any of that. The media, they say, you know, here it is, you know, try. So that this is the idea. We don't really do news. The alternative media doesn't do news. It does analysis really more often.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's gotten much worse. There was a time just as recently as the 70s, maybe even the 80s, if you watch a news show, there's actually much more information in this, much more conversation than you see today. Anything. I remember just watching something as frivolous as Entertainment Tonight in the 1980s. It was relatively substantive. I mean, it talked about new movies that were coming out, new projects. You know, something in entertainment. It was substantive relative to entertainment. A new album coming out. Something, you know, so you could watch it, and there were like news reports. And I haven't watched it in a while, but I just remember watching those shows. It was all about scandal and what celebrities are doing. And it's like that show TMZ, right?
Yeah, which blends into the modern news broadcast.
You know,
and you can't really tell one from the other. Yeah. I mean, basically, if you look at, see, even something like CNN or Fox News, which, I mean, I wouldn't even, you know, try to put forward the illusion that they're supposedly, you know, news stations. But these propaganda devices have typically it's reporting on terrorism, right? You have the local terrorism. You have the terrorism in the Middle East. I mean, these are the two great themes of the world. So you have terrorism to traumatize. You have the lives of celebrity, right? This is another theme that you'll see typically. You know what they'll with a wink and a nod, you know, mention something that happened to a Kardashian or something. And then, you know, you've got sports, but the political presentation is almost invariably concerning scandal, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you don't have the economic realities of the United States being discussed. You've got, well, is Trump an obstructionist? And then if you can throw in, you know, a current assassination like the other day, the tragic events at the baseball field, well, then you can combine terrorism with political distraction. And I mean, it's just a perfect way to get the citizen to be thinking about other things than, you know, who's controlling him or her.
Yeah, or you can use it, you know, to actually try to shut down the internet like Theresa May attempted out in the UK.
Wants to, yeah.
You know, just immediately jumps to attacking the internet.
Yeah.
And it goes from terrorism to extremists. Two aren't necessarily the same. I mean,
they're not.
And what's your definition of extreme? It all depends on where you stand on the political spectrum, I suppose. But
yeah, the analysis of, you know, when they have extremists, I mean, you know, they have like, if you think about the, you know, who are the political mavericks that have been in our media over the last like 3 or 4 months. You've got the guy who walked into Comet Ping Pong and fired off a round, right?
Yeah.
He was like basically promoting the fake news impact, right? This would be like, well, my God, you know, this terrible situation. We have to shut down the internet because it's promoting fake news, and look what's happened. And then you have this guy, was it yesterday? I mean, I get my terrorist events confused. Who shot the Republicans at the baseball field?
Yeah, early morning at the baseball. Yeah, shot at them practicing baseball. Yeah.
Yeah. But so you have the terrorism, but this is what is our political news. I mean, in a sane world, you would make a comment on that and then go into the, you know, the substance of citizenry.
Yeah, right?
So you might notice it, but that isn't how our media operates. And you can see in that very act that they are designed as weapons. Because rather than go, you know, here the country is teetering on the brink of economic collapse. It's been waging nonstop war for 20 years. I mean, it has false flags being executed by the government. And what we're talking about is a act of violence on a baseball field.
Well, yeah, some guy takes some wacko. And I was listening to a show today. It's like talking about what we really have now is we have a bunch of Manchurian citizens running around because everyone's so crazed and excited and anxious and through the rhetoric, you know, these are the people that positively hate Trump. They're told to resist by all means and these things. So you're creating sort of one guy referred to just a bunch of Manchurian citizens running around who can easily be goaded into doing one of these things. There's endless amount of, you know, self-styled desperados or revolutionaries or just yahoos willing to do something like this. They can easily be kind of goaded into it by a handler who's behind the scenes. So this might have been genuine. This might not. I don't know. You know, these things. 320 million people in this country. A lot of crazy people. So it can happen. But again, this why this guy takes a shot and unfortunately wounds a congressman. At the same time, you have the United States government, you know, toppling governments, fomenting civil wars in North Africa and the Middle East, causing the suffering of untold millions, the death of thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions over the years. You know, what's going on in Syria right now, you know?
It's incredible.
What happened in Libya? What NATO did to Libya, you know?
Libya was just, it's a slaughter. I mean, basically, the moral structure of our foreign policy was given to the world in the position paper of the Project for the New American Century, 1999. Mm-hmm. And it listed seven countries that had to be basically enslaved, and it described the enslavement of them. It said, you know, we need full spectrum dominance, and it very clear, what did that mean? Control of their media, their water, their air, food production. I mean, it was just hard-edged slavery. It listed seven countries. These are the ones they've been going after. Iran, I think, is the only one that hasn't been hit so far. But then they really showed the position, the moral position of these individuals. And incidentally, Joe Biden, the Democrat, it wasn't just the Bush neocon Republicans and the dual citizens Israelis who signed it, but Joe Biden signed it. Mm-hmm. It advocated the development of a ethnic-specific biological weapon. I mean, people, when I tell this to people, they always think this is science fiction. I go, no, you've got Google. Just type in PNAC ethnic bioweapon. You'll get to see what the moral perspective of our government really is. And this just shows that there is a partition. You know, we think that we have some kind of impact through the voting system into the ruling elite, but we don't. That's just an illusion as great as like the Kardashian family structure.
That's what Miles Mathis pointed out in his article, talking about back in the 20s, the roaring 20s, the era of jazz. They were trying to do this in the 20s, and it failed, promote the sexual revolution, primarily by giving women the right to vote.
Yeah.
And he goes, listen, I'm for equality, believe me, but listen, the vote was meaningless back in 1922, back in 1920s. It's just that, you know, basically, you know, the oligarchs know how to get the men elected. They want to get elected to do the job for them. Giving women the right to vote didn't solve anything. It just made them as noisy and as bothersome as men, more or less.
So he says, and of course, it was a part of the process to get them out of the house. So you don't want a nuclear family. That's a political structure that is dangerous to the oligarchs.
Yeah.
So you got to break it up. And that first, you got to get the male to separate from the family and move into pornography. The woman has to separate from the family and move into the workforce.
Yeah, these are the same women that could be tricked into becoming addicted, you know, cigarette smokers just through an ad, you know.
And I hate to say it, but, you know, that goes right back to the same individual.
Yeah.
That's Edward Bernays. With
come a long way, baby.
Yeah. I mean, that was, you know, Edward Bernays, we should sometime do a show on him. I mean, he's one of the most profound arch criminals in our history. I mean, he rivals the fantasies, the worst fantasies about Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just how destructive this guy was. And so, you know, he had this project whereby he would both promote feminism and cigarette smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called Torches of Freedom. Right. No, you can see how, remember, this is Sigmund Freud's nephew, right?
Yeah.
Torches of Freedom. And these are cigarettes. Right. So this is how you can manipulate people. You give them the idea that this is something that is, remember, liberating, like sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Yeah, it's the same thing, yeah.
Same thing, right. So you can see that they, and then feminism with Gloria Steinem and that whole, you know, structure of control.
That's interesting because Freudianism itself, psychoanalysis, was, you know, it's been more or less a black op against Christian society, a Jewish black op.
Absolutely.
But I mean, the whole idea there was psychosis was derived through inhibition. So you cure inhibition, you cure psychosis by losing all inhibition.
I mean, it's just ludicrous. It's like Freud, if he was a serious scientist, he would be such a crackpot.
Yeah.
He would have been laughed off of, out of any kind of serious, you know, kind of academic world he entered into.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't. He was promoted. He was a rock star. He was just Elvis Presley with a therapist couch. I mean, he was just there to come up with these ludicrous explanations about neurosis that all had to do with the promotion, ultimately, of pornography.
Well, that's something. Yeah, I mean, look at the earlier on, you mentioned the authoritarian personality. And this is more or less a declaration of ethnic warfare on the United States by the American Jewish Committee.
Yeah, I would say that's a very accurate description of it.
But the excuse for that, I always hear, is, well, they were reacting to Hitler. This was post-World War II. Holocaust, these things.
Yeah.
The only problem is this agenda predates Hitler.
Of course it does. You can easily see the agenda of the Frankfurt School being produced by Gregor Lukacs, who was using the same agenda at the conclusion of World War I.
Yeah.
When Lukacs was given control over the education of Hungary, he arranged to have a completely debased sexuality taught to the high school kids. You know, he was using the classic Marxist meme of marriage creating the woman as property. But that's just the darn cover narrative. In back of it was this very static structure of, we've got to get these people to basically become more sexualized. We have to take sex out of marriage, because then marriage is not attractive, you see.
Mm-hmm.
When the only way that sex is promoted culturally is in the marriage, then the males particularly are focused on getting a mate, a marriage, right? So all you have to do is just move sexuality out of marriage, and then there you are. Then you're on your way to this atomized society where you have nothing but a nation of slaves.
And what you really have, a bunch of lonely people, because it's not like everyone's having more sex. It's that a few males have a lot more girls to choose from, because all those girls are told they can chase men who either married or unmarried. And then you just have a bunch of marginalized people who are unhappy and lonely.
Yeah, what the males have is pornography.
Yeah.
Which actually damages real sexuality. Pornography is the final nail in the coffin of healthy and real sexuality.
Oh, yeah. It takes only one element of sexuality.
Yeah.
It makes it the only element of sexuality. And that deprives it of its true meaning.
The visual sexuality applied to young women. And the pornography is, you know, it's just the final nail in the coffin of basically of the capacity to defend yourself.
It also makes the, particularly the male, but most people in general, it arrests development. It makes them perpetual adolescents. Hence the baby boomers, right?
Yeah, exactly. Never grow up.
And their damaged progeny. You know.
Well, they never even know their father, or you know, or have any strong connection. So you have been successful at both birth control, so that people don't produce families, and atomizing the families that did come into existence. In other words, the women that gave birth, because now single moms, I mean, particularly in the African-American community, I've seen statistics, Tim, that are just so they're just beyond belief how few marriages are actually now being produced in some components of that culture. And of course, the so-called white middle class is never far behind, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it always moves. We always move in the same direction. We all drift in the same culture. So, you know, it's just harder and harder for white middle class people to have children.
That reminds me of the movie about 20 years ago called Pleasantville, if you remember.
Yeah.
Where these two kids are, I guess, go back in time to the 1950s, and the movie becomes black and white, you know, almost like reverse Wizard of Oz. And people don't become colorized till they have illicit sex.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Hollywood.
They come alive. But the whole focus of the movie was that no one was having sex in the 1950s. Well, really, that was the middle of the baby boom.
Except for the baby boom.
How did that happen?
Yeah, so it's ludicrous, right? There was probably more sex than now in the pornographic era.
Yeah.
No actual sex, right? You know, now you have more pornography, mm-hmm. but you have, I think, a lot less sex is what I would suspect, actually. So, you know, it's not a hard program once you've got a few basic kind of facts uncovered to really understand.
That's what you have to do. I mean, you have to introduce the nature of the music industry, the entertainment industry, and what elements control it, the organized crime, you know, the Jewish mafia, the intelligence agencies. And if you get that element or that, if you understand that dimension to who's producing our entertainment fare, what we consume, our information, then you realize, yeah, it makes sense. And if you know the names, the dates, you know, the chronology, most people just don't understand that. Most people think that, you know, haven't done the proper research.
Well, that's right. And they don't, it never occurs to them that this was weaponized.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they think of Elvis as, you know, gee, he was like a great American, you know, just, you know, and that they just watch history unfold. See, mm-hmm. this is that's the main problem, is that instead of looking at the progression from, you know, and a lot of this wouldn't even be aware of, but like from Gregor Lucas to the Frankfurt School to the American Jewish Committee to the Macy Conference to MK Ultra to Elvis Presley to the Beatles to the Rolling Stones to pornography, right?
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't see all of that as a linked project. They would just say, well, that's just what happened. Like, almost like, well, that was just the world we lived in, you know? But it had nothing to do with an organic process. Once you start knowing a few of the facts, you can just see it. That idea is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
It was designed. We were brought here. And we need to know that so that they can stop damaging us. Once you know that, when you see like the MTV award show,
yes. right,
with Miley Cyrus portraying an animal in the sex act, you know, it, once you know that this is there specifically to damage your mind, to make you more easy to enslave. Right. Once you get it, you won't be as likely to be hurt by this stuff. You'll find a way to defend yourself. If for nothing else, you get away from it, to stop just sitting there and letting them have access to your mind. Once you realize that we're being attacked, then one thing that's easy to do is just turn off the media they're using to attack you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just turn it off. Don't pay for it. You get the cable TV.
Don't pay for it. Don't let it get near you. And if you have children, for God's sakes, under no circumstances let them have access to the internet. They just don't need it. Give them a book. You know, the internet should be strictly for adults, and strictly for adults that are aware that it is being used as a weapon by very evil, very sophisticated people.
Well, I mean, again, you just do the cursory research on these topics. Like, I mean, it's obvious that the Grateful Dead were an intelligence operation. They were there to promote LSD. Their concerts were there to promote LSD, as you and Jan pointed out. You know, this, you know, there was a, it was, yeah, a, they were manufactured. They were manufactured by the CIA. LSD was a CIA project. So, and they were promoted by what? The Hitchcock family, and along with Timothy Leary at their mansion.
Helen banking family.
Yeah,
for six, and Sasha Shulgin, the Bohemian Grove member. Look, the Grateful Dead is nothing but a cesspool of secret societies and military intelligence and banking families.
Yeah.
It's the same cesspool that you can see in like the military intelligence in World War II with the OSS, and then on and into the CIA, where you have nothing but banking lawyers being the heads of the CIA for the first 50 years or something. You know,
well, like Gordon Wasson, right? J.P. Morgan?
And Gordon Wasson, for God's sake. I mean, you know, the supposed discoverer of the magic mushroom. I mean, he's vice president of J.P. Morgan. He's chairing the meetings of the Council of Foreign Relations. I mean, there's just a regular guy, just happened to be interested in mushrooms. I mean, this is ridiculous. People need to snap out of it.
Well, I mean, that was like the opium trade was there to, you know, it wasn't just there to reverse the balance of trade between China and Great Britain. The British East India Company, which became a huge financial combine, and you know, recognized that it could be easily weaponized to render, you know, Chinese society more vulnerable to penetration, exploitation. But here, I mean, they spread LSD. They were, you know, like Johnny Appleseed. They spread it around at these concerts, these rock festivals that were promoted by corporate America, by the intelligence agencies, whether it's Monterey or Woodstock and these things. But before that, you had the. I mean, this is all documented. Operation Midnight Climax with George Hunter White, and they were dosing, testing people. This is they're doing, and he was like a narcotics officer, really CIA. But this shows you just the system is completely opposite of what it's supposed to do. They're actually promoting drug use. They're experimenting with it. He had that famous quote, George Hunter White. He goes, "I was a very minor missionary, actually a heretic, but I toiled wholeheartedly in the vineyards because it was fun, fun, fun. Where else could a red-blooded American boy lie, kill, cheat, steal, rape, and pillage with the sanction and blessings of the All Highest." You know,
wow.
You know, that was, you know, yeah. So there's your
intelligence agencies,
yeah,
right there. You know, and that should just alert people. Look, there is a bifurcation. You've got the population, and you have the rulers. The rulers have a different set of morals and ethics, and they can. I mean. When you think about the Grateful Dead, or even like, how about the acid tests, right, where they played at? Now, here you're giving out LSD, which is, of course, studied as a psychotic-producing drug, right? This is how these individuals are looking at this. This is Nicholas Burkell is looking, you know, they're talking about it. The reason we're studying LSD is because it produces schizophrenia, and we can create a temporary schizophrenia so that we can supposedly study this phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these are the same individuals who then work to promote it en masse in the acid test, where they're giving it out to everyone. So this means that these individuals have this moral perspective, right, of we don't care if they all die. They're like animals to us.
Yeah.
See, this is you have to, you know, remember what you're dealing with here. You couldn't do the acid tests. You know, if you look at the actual moral background of what the people are thinking, you know, when they're putting it, you couldn't do something like that if you had even the slightest concern about someone becoming permanently insane, right?
Yeah.
It just wouldn't be possible. So this is what you're dealing with. This is how vicious and how insane the secret society that rules this country is. It is that vicious that it could do something like the acid tests, knowing that there would be a fraction of these people that would never probably be sane again.
Yeah, permanently scarred. And those that weren't, they would have internalized a significant portion of those attitudes and mores. So they themselves, this is what these figures serve. These, you know, I've always likened figures like Gloria Steinem or Aleister Crowley as sort of chemical, you know, what do you call it? Not a compound, but sort of a mix, and you turn
it's an elixir, a brew that's been, you know, that they've
Yeah, I mean,
compounded, you know, they've created so that, that it now it is it will hurt you.
Yeah, it will. I mean, basically, it's yeah, they put a little bit in the well and it poisons the well. Not everyone's going to be as extreme as Gloria Steinem, but they'll internalize enough of what she purports to believe that they'll emerge damaged. You know,
exactly. You know, I mean. Ms. Magazine would damage every single woman that ever read it to some extent.
Yeah, women don't even call themselves feminists. They internalize the beliefs, you know, enough that they're misguided and confused, and you know,
they're less likely to have families.
Yeah, and you know? And you mentioned some of these. Another figure was Jolyon West, the MK Ultra doctor, who shows up, you know, at Jack Ruby's cell to talk to him. Deals with Patty Hearst and Sirhan Sirhan, and even Timothy McVeigh. He's like a zealot character popping up at these places.
Yeah, there's actually a letter written by Huxley to, I think his name is Humphrey Osmond. I could be mispronouncing it, but he was his hatchet man, telling him to go to Jolly West and to run a particular MKUltra experiment. It's a very important letter. I think it's actually, Jan Irwin posted it in one of his articles. But he got it from, I believe, Acid Dreams.
Uh-huh.
And the reason why it's so important is it shows that Huxley is an administrator of MKUltra because the documents came forward that actually identified Jolly West. And I'm pretty sure they could actually determine that what sub-project of MKUltra Huxley was administrating, saying, okay, go there, get this experiment done in this fashion. And this is really critical because not only does it, you know, show basically that, and remember, Huxley is not a CIA officer, right? So the fact that he's, you know, basically telling Jolly West what to do while Jolly West is on the MKUltra payroll shows you that there is a level above the CIA, right?
Yeah,
the CIA.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not a rogue outfit that somehow went astray, that they're part of this larger group. And it also shows the that Huxley is just an absolute liar because he went on Mike Wallace interview, which is on the internet, talking about how dangerous it would be for government to get control over drugs because, you know, then they would, you know, have the capacity to rule the world through them, you know. And he was then saying, well, you know, like in my strange book, you know, Brave New World, I was really trying to alert people. Like, well, even though there's nothing in the book which really talks about that. But so he was saying this. But that's the same time he's working with MKUltra to give the government the exact powers that he's supposedly warning people against. So you see, he's just a complete liar, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just an absolute tip-to-stern liar, and he's a lifetime actor.
Yeah, yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And that's what we've been. And you, but you, when you think about them, you see how sophisticated they are, how they are well organized, right? And that they control the intelligence. Operations. They control the government.
Mm-hmm. Well, the CIA is an agency, and therefore it is acting on the part of some entity or some body, and that's you know that. So agencies act on behalf of somebody, and that's you know. So they're not acting alone. You know. So the word I was thinking of was constant. It's a chemical concentrate, and
exactly
these figures are concentrate, and you dilute it with water, and you disperse it. You know, and obviously its concentrate is too toxic. To use on its own, but you divert it with water, and you can disperse it, you know, as you please. And that's what these figures are like. They're concentrating. You put them in they're poured into the cultural well, and it poisons the well. And you know that's what they've done. Now, of course, I was mentioned Jolly West. As far as drugs, he has that quote in his 1975 book, Hallucinations, Behavior, Experience, and Theory, and he wrote, "The role of drugs." In the exercise of political controls is also coming under increasing discussion. Control can be through prohibition or supply. The total or even partial prohibition of drugs gives the government considerable leverage for some types of control. An example would be the selective application of drug laws against selected components of the population, such as members of a certain minority groups or political organizations. Because that's the drug war. But there's also the drugs being used to opiate society, to you know, to pollute society, to degrade society, and they certainly did that too. So they're not only, you know, this goes to the whole thing. you know, they import the drugs, then they enforce the drug laws to maintain the cartels, maintain control, to maintain the high prices and able to control the situation. And that's what most people still don't understand, you know, about the drug war, about law enforcement, these things. That's being entirely manipulated.
Isn't it a little weird and creepy that the guy who, like, was basically did interviews with Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby and Tim McVeigh
and Patty Hearst?
It's like, you know, like theorizing about drug control of individuals by the government. I mean, what the heck is going on here? He shouldn't be theorizing about these things. What? He's not being paid for this. He's supposed to be a researcher.
I know.
He's talking about these broad, you know, government powers based on drug expertise. I mean, why is that even in forefront in his mind? Of course, we know now. I mean, this is why the MKUltra pay requisitions were just invaluable. Breath of fresh air of honesty for the citizen, because it named doctors.
Yeah. And the fact that he can say these things or write these things and not expect, you know, to be lynched.
Well, he should be, and there should be a media investigation if we had any kind of real government.
Yeah, because
with all of these assassins.
This is a government scientist, and he's talking about manipulation through drugs, all these things, and then he's interviewing these so-called lone wolf assassins that are involved in these high-profile assassinations and events, and Patty Hearst.
Yeah. It's just a massive red flag.
Well, I mean, you mentioned earlier, the different moral, I guess, realm that these people operate in. That's why most people don't understand it. Yet they say these things, they're never held accountable, whether it's Brzezinski we talked about last week. Another figure is Henry Kissinger, right?
I mean,
you're talking about in 1974, he pens this memorandum, the National Security Study Memorandum 200, where he openly calls for mass death in the Third World and impoverishment in order to free up the resources for the West.
It's just incredible.
And he's still considered a statesman. He says, you talk about, we have to increase like the death rate by 20%. Otherwise they'll put undue pressure on the world's resources. You know, this misanthropic, Malthusian view of the world. We have to do this because there's just too many of them down there, you know?
Right. So of course, when you see, you know, sort of the MK Ultra attack, that Kissinger was part of, against our own population, you know, at that point, then, see, he's lost the ability to use the sophistry. He can't just come up with a clever argument and say, you know, we got to kill 20% of the people because of this is actually, let me explain, and it's a very complicated deal, and but it's going to end up good. Well, you know, once you know the background, you know this is just the ludicrous cover story, and all he really wants to do is genocide.
Yeah.
That's really what he's about.
Well, we began this conversation regarding Elvis Presley, and there is a nice way that Miles Mathis sums it up. But let me see if I can find it. Should have it marked here. About sort of, what we should take away from the article. And this is what he says about Elvis Presley being an intelligent operation. He goes, every famous person I have researched so far has been part of some hoax. Some of my assumptions now is that almost every famous person who died early or mysteriously has faked it for some reason. That should also be your default assumption. Rather than assume that you are being told by the mainstream, you're being told by the mainstream is true, you should assume it is false. If they tell you it is day, assume it is night.
Yeah. That's well said. That's exactly right. You just have to assume that what they're telling you is to damage you.
Mm-hmm.
It's all fake. Their whole construction of reality is artificial, and it is constructed specifically to keep us from knowing, you know, what's happening to us, knowing that we are being dumbed down, bred out of existence, and just flat out genocided. I mean, that's really what this is all about.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, let's hope that the next time people hit the radio and there's Elvis, that instead of just getting the pelvis engaged, they also maybe get the precortical areas of the brain moving.
That's right. Well, that's, you know, that's the center of gravity in rock and roll is below the waist.
You ain't kidding.
So that's why they call it rock and roll.
Yeah, that's the role.
So, okay, listen, well, Joe, thanks a lot.
Hey, Tim, great talking to you, buddy, and we'll get together next week, okay?
Yeah, we'll get to we'll come up with something, and hey, enjoy the weekend.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye-bye.